Okay, good. Let us go ahead and start. Joshua, you write that for centuries the myth of the lone genius has towered over us like a colossus. Do you think there's no such thing as a lone genius?
There is no such thing as a lone genius. That's my contention. In order to understand how that could possibly be true, you have to look at all of the varieties of the electric experience, the experience of chemistry between people, and look at the way that hidden partners are often involved in seminal works like Vincent van Gogh's brother Theo, Charlie Munger, who's Warren Buffett's silent partner, all of the producers and all the people who are behind the scenes. And you also have to understand that people affect each other working from different parts of a creative field. So you might have two people that we know independently, like Pablo Picasso and Henri Matisse, who really affected each other, and you could even say made each other's careers, even though they had independent bodies of work.
And they were rivals, actually. I mean, they were sort of competing against each other, I suppose you could say.
That's right. It takes all kinds of forms, and it also has all kinds of affective experiences. It feels very differently to be buoyed up and charged up and improved by another person, and it may actually feel, in a way, very unpleasant because it's kind of instigating, it's vexing. You're being pushed beyond a place of comfort, but that, of course, is absolutely integral to creativity.
So why have we had this idea of the lone genius for so long, for centuries?
You know, it goes back hundreds of years, and it's a fascinating history, but to summarize it radically, number one, it's a very effective story for creativity, which is inherently elusive. Number two, it meshes very well with a market economy where people really need to assign ownership in a very particular way. And it grew up alongside this romantic myth that was very much tied to a kind of pragmatic need to assign very particular authorship or ownership over creative work. But the simple answer is that it makes such a good story. It's just so clear. It's so compelling. We love to look at the guy in the spotlight. We love to have a single face shining out at us from a magazine cover or a biography or a documentary. And looking at relationships is so much more complicated, both for an audience and for the people involved.
Now, it seems that there's another model for creativity, especially in this computer age, and that's the network model, collaboration among many people. And yet you've chosen to focus on very creative pairs instead of the network.
That's right. The network is a very true model for understanding the way human beings interact with each other. We're hugely affected by all kinds of forces around us, but it's enormously complicated, it's very hard to grasp, and it's really disconnected from our everyday experience in which we have ideas and we discuss them with people and we are emotional and we are intellectual and we are in connection. And so this idea of creative intimacy is really critical as a way of bringing creativity down to the everyday experience. And the way to see that is through pairs of people.
Two people working together in one form or another.
That's right. And it's also true the pair is an enormously productive creative unit, responsible for a staggering amount of creative work. And it also helps us model this, what I call the dialogical phenomenon of creativity, that this sense of two things being in conversation with one another and a third thing, or a sort of single greater thing emerging from it.
Well, you talk about creative pairs as forming what you call a single organism. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. When two people meet, they might be excited by each other. There might be a kind of, you know, feeling of jolt. Ralph Abernathy and Martin Luther King, or Sergey Brin and Larry Page, and yet you still have two distinct individuals. Over time, when people begin to work together and they become associated with a common body of work, or they become wrapped up in each other, a we emerges. And that is an enormously interesting phenomenon because, of course, the individuals remain and there is a sense of distinct ego, but that also begins to break down as you become part of this larger thing. And the science of relationships has shown us that at a very basic cognitive level, we begin to lose the distinctions between ourselves and other people, so that the we is not just a figure of speech and a way of talking. It's also becomes a part of the way we think, and there is even a phenomenon of a shared mind.
Well, it's interesting that you used the example of Ralph Abernathy and Martin Luther King, because Dr. King, of course, is seen as the great leader of the civil rights movement. He's not generally paired with Ralph Abernathy. I mean, of course, historians of the civil rights movement know of him, but they would see him as a secondary figure.
That's right. And it's very common that one person in these partnerships is out front, and one person may be the decided leader. That was certainly the case with Martin Luther King. They were a partnership, and they were not entirely equal. And Martin Luther King was also the spokesman and the philosopher king of that movement. It's very appropriate to understand his distinct role and what he did that was different from Abernathy. But it's very hard to understand what they created without looking at without looking at the two of them together. And that happens over and over again. When you begin to understand relationships, you have to rewrite the Western canon.
So play that out for me a little bit. I mean, how did the coming together of Abernathy and King create some kind of new dynamism?
Sure. Martin Luther King was an abstract man. He was an intellectual man. He thought in these big ways, and he had a soaring intellect. Abernathy, which was much more of a tactician, he had a very earthy sense of humor. He was the one who could really get the crowd riled up and could really connect with them in a really basic way. And he would set the stage for King to come and, you know, give this overview and speak not just to that particular audience. He was really speaking to the nation and to the world about the philosophy of nonviolence, which, you know, is not necessarily the thing that is going to get, you know, the crowded black church sort of roused up and ready for the particular action of that day. But it's also true that a lot of what happened between King and Abernathy is hard to trace. They were on the road together. They shared hotel rooms and motel rooms together. In fact, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, he was in a suite at the Lorraine Motel that they called the King Abernathy Suite because they shared it so often together. And we don't know precisely what they said. And after King was gone, Abernathy was the only, firsthand witness, of course, and people don't necessarily trust everything he said. Maybe his ego was involved. So it's hard to get at a lot of these relationships because so much is unrecorded.
Now, you write about a lot of creative pairs, and one of the most interesting ones was the partnership between C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Of course, went on to write famous books in their own rights, but how would you describe their creative partnership?
It was a partnership between two distinct men who each authored his own independent body of work, and yet, in a way, they co-created this form of the mythic parable soaked in Christian imagery, and they did it through relentless conversation. They met each other. They were academics in a kind of stuffy environment. A lot of their colleagues would have thought them entirely foolish for thinking about the stories that they thought about made-up languages and talking lions and all that sort of thing. And yet they got each other. They loved the work that each man was doing, and they gave each other permission and were an audience and were an ever-present critic and responder and resonator for what the other did. They met privately for lunch almost every week for a long period, and they had a group that they created around them called the Inklings that went on for many years. And you could really say in the big picture that they co-created each other as authors, even though they are not co-authors in the ordinary sense.
So how did they do that? I mean, would they show each other their work, or would they read it out loud? I mean, what was the nature of the creative interaction?
They did both. They showed each other drafts on paper, and they also read aloud to each other and to this group regularly. And as many writers know, that's the single best way to experience your work yourself and to be aware of an audience and also to get response. And they were brutal with each other. When they didn't like something, they went at each other very hard. You know, the other thing that's really important to understand that they help illustrate is solitude remains an enormously important part of the creative process, even when there's connection happening. And we tend to think that those are two opposed phenomena, but in fact, solitude is really facilitated and made possible by an appropriate amount of connection. And it's the work that you do in solitude, bringing that to a place of relationship, allows it to get bigger and be stronger. And then feeling connected is what allows you to go back into your cave and do the work that you may only be able to do alone.
Well, you give the example, going back to particularly this creative partnership between C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, of the critique that Lewis made of Tolkien's poem, The Lay of Lethian. Am I saying that right?
Yes, I believe so.
What did Lewis say about this poem?
Well, you know, he said that he was stunned by it and he loved it and he was full of rapturous praise, and then he followed with a very meticulous and pointed criticism, but he did it in such a playful way that it conveyed enormous respect for what Tolkien had done and really charged him up. And a lot of the ideas, a lot of the criticisms were things that Tolkien was working on many years after Lewis had delivered his critique.
So it's as if Tolkien was mulling over this for a long time. I mean, he didn't just sort of turn around and, you know, make instant corrections or revisions. It stayed with him.
That's right.
Yeah. And you refer to this as praise-based criticism.
I do. I came up with that phrase to try to convey the strange way in which a kind of aggression and a kind of negativity gets mixed up with a kind of warmth and affirmation. And that is so often the case in these relationships, that challenge becomes combined with a kind of, a kind of connection. And that's that strange beast made up of these two apparently opposed qualities is so much of what gives a pair its character. We see the same thing in these relationships over and over again.
Now, we've been talking about the advantages of these kind of creative pairs and, you know, how people feed off each other, get inspired by other people, work with the criticisms that they hear. Are there negatives as well that come sometimes with these creative relationships?
Absolutely. I mean, part of the challenge is framing it as a pure negative when it may actually bring out such great work. And if you've had the experiences I've had being criticized, being challenged, and you know, feeling I'm devastated when my editor or when a member of my writer's group or my literary agent, when I hear that something some dream I've been nurturing, some pages that I've been laboring over for weeks or months, when I get a blow to the, you know, to the body with a critique of that work. But it may be that precisely that blow, precisely that criticism is the most important, the most valuable thing that's happened, you know, in my creative life in that period. And so negativity in a pure way is not necessarily the best way to think of it. At the same time, of course, it is hard to be criticized. It is hard to be pushed. And it's hard on a very basic level to be in exchange with people who are fundamentally different from you. And that's always the case in these great pairs, that there's some animating difference. I just bumped the mic. Should I re-say?
Yeah, that's fine. Don't worry about that. Yeah.
I'm going to pause for a second to just get an example other than Lennon McCartney, because they're my favorite example for animating difference. For animating difference that becomes highly vexing later on.
Can you think of an example like this?
Yes, that's what I'm just give me one moment.
Yeah, sure.
I've gotten worn into certain grooves talking about this book, and this is always the moment that I like to talk about John and Paul.
Right.
Well, I do, if I could give you one of my most beautiful, one of the lines that I love the most. Give me 1 second, mm-hmm, so long sure. as we're off. Mm-hmm. William James is one of my favorite psychologists, and he was writing to a former student of his named Dickinson Miller, and he described him as my most penetrating critic and my most intimate enemy. And that, I think, is a very beautiful way of describing what we're getting at. And of course, it has both the sunny and the dark entwined. Picasso and Matisse are another very fine example of this. They gave each other ideas. They set a standard for one another, but they also really bugged each other. Matisse was very bugged by the way that Picasso would sort of absorb and almost steal his ideas, he thought. And, you know, he said once that you can't let that guy in your studio. You know, he's kind of like a vagabond.
And of course, these were two of the towering geniuses who helped create 20th century art. But they had their own distinctive styles, but they were clearly paying attention to each other.
Paying extremely close attention. As they were paying attention of the sort that you would pay to an opponent on the other side of the net in a tennis match or in any kind of sporting contest or in a chess game. And these sports metaphors often come up as a way of trying to describe that sense of very close and intense opposition. But of course, unlike in a very particular game, they're also making each other better. And you can take that back to the realm of sports and say, that actually happens in sports over and over again. And this phenomenon of pairs, whether it's Frazier and Ali, or Chris Everett and Martina Navratilova, or Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, this happens over and over again, that rivalries really define not only two individual players, but a whole era in sports.
Well, and to follow up on the example of Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, two of the all-time great NBA players, my sense is they were kind of obsessed with each other and, you know, carefully tracked how many championships the other guy won, and they wanted to best the other guy.
The obsessed is a perfect word for it. It was just on their mind every day. Larry Bird says he would go out and take practice shots, and he'd be up to hundreds of practice shots, maybe 500, and he'd say, you know, I bet Magic did 800 a day, and he would stay out there and keep going. He would go get the morning paper whenever he woke up in Boston and see what the Lakers had done, and he wanted to thrash Magic, and even years later, he talks with evident glee about not only beating Magic, but making Magic suffer. And yet at the same time, when Magic retired from the NBA, in this moment that really seemed tragic, he said that he had the HIV virus and many people thought it was a death sentence. Bird retired at the end of the same season. He said there was no point playing on without the hope of meeting Magic in the finals.
Wow. He had lost his foil.
He had, and now they're great pals, and they have done all kinds of projects together. There's been a book and a documentary and a musical, and there's so much warmth and affection, and they feel entirely linked. Bird says, wherever he goes in the world, people say, "Where's Magic?" It's like he's his shadow. He's the other half of his life.
Yeah. Now, one of the most interesting stories you write about is about the poet Emily Dickinson, and she would seem to be the poster child of the lone genius, off in her room creating these incredible poems. But you say that's a mistake to see her that way.
This is an important story for me because I'm a writer, and I need an enormous amount of solitude. And my creative relationship with my book editor is very much in the rhythm of solitude and connection alternating with each other in a variety of ways. And I was dumbfounded to learn about Emily Dickinson and to see my idea of her, an idea that many people shared, that she was tremendously isolated and disconnected from the world around her in order to make these beautiful poems alone in her room is really not the full picture. It is true that she withdrew from the world around her, that she didn't leave her father's home, that she didn't obey these social niceties, but she was doing that not to be disengaged, but because she needed a lot of space in her mind and around her in order to think and to gestate these letters and these poems, which she sent out like missives to the world. And she not only did that to connect with people in an abstract way, she was continually reaching out and choosing people to be her correspondents, to be her mentors, to be her editors in a way, and sending hundreds of poems to these people and thousands of letters. And if you look at the material of her work, it's electric with emotion and interpersonal passion. And this was something that she was deeply consumed by. So it's a story of her, and we need to revise our understanding of Dickinson, but it's also a broader story of people who need solitude, not because they're disinterested in the human world around them, but because from a place of solitude, they can, and from a place of solitude, they can connect better. And from a place of solitude, they can do the things that they do best. Steve Wozniak is another example in a totally different field in a different era, but he needed a lot of space around him to tinker with his gadgets and to work out these engineering problems. But it really became magic when he was able to bring that to someone like Steve Jobs, who knew how to shape it and knew how to market it and knew how to send him back into his cave with a particular assignment. And that movement is really critical to understand and really personal to me because it's so much part of my life as a writer.
Yeah. Well, to go back to the example of Emily Dickinson, I can imagine this might have worked in two ways. So if she's writing a poem and she sends it to someone else, that other person might write back with comments about it, maybe even criticisms, or the other person might just be kind of the audience that she needs. In other words, she sort of has that person in mind as she's writing the poem.
I think that's a very incisive observation. And sometimes what we need from someone is a certain kind of presence, is a certain kind of receptive attitude. And that stirs us up and brings something out of us. And we're not necessarily looking for any particular response. I know that's the case in my life too, that I write differently, I speak differently, I feel like I am a different person in relationship to other people. And sometimes it's not any kind of discrete thing they say or do, it's the feeling that it generates in me. And that's something I'm really at the bottom of this whole inquiry for me. I'm just fascinated by that feeling of chemistry and all the places it can lead.
All right. I mean, there's a huge difference between, let's say, keeping a journal that is really just for yourself. You don't care if anyone else reads. In fact, you don't want anyone else to read it. And writing for the public, for publication in some way where, I mean, you have a reader, maybe an idealized reader in mind, and that helps shape what you're writing.
There is a huge difference, and that's obviously core to my study. I'm interested in the way people are other-directed. What's fascinating, though, is that when you really begin to appreciate how much of creativity is dialogical, how much of it is shaped in literal or metaphorical conversation between people, and you then take that model and look at how the creative mind works when we're walking on a beach or we're in front of a computer writing by ourselves, what happens in our mind is also a dialogical phenomenon. When you listen to creative people from Paul Simon to the great poet Ruth Stone, when you listen to creative people describe these aha moments, these moments of insight and genesis, it's an experience of two forces, two places in their mind, or sometimes it seems like it's something from outside of your mind that's sort of transmitting to you. It's very hard to describe, and that's the reason why this old idea, this old myth of the muse is actually helpful, whether you believe in it as a true phenomenon or not. It's useful as a model for how the creative mind works.
The muse being, I mean, people actually, it's as if some, let's say, writers or musicians would say, you know, I was inspired by almost this divine presence. It was like I was almost communicating or being fed some creative inspiration by the muse.
That's right. And whether you believe that it's something outside of you, which many people do, or you think it's coming up from your unconscious, or maybe you've really studied the science of human development and you understand that, you know, we actually consist of a variety of models that we take in from other people. So a small child talking to his mom, and in that external conversation, that gets downloaded, so to speak, and becomes a kind of internal conversation, which is what thinking is to begin with. And creative thinking is when that happens in a very clear and a very clear channel, and it kind of moves from point A to point B to point C, and there's development and progression, when so much of our thinking is often an experience of not having that movement and being kind of stuck, or having multiple voices, 5 or 8 or 10 voices sort of clamoring in our head, which is what the meditators call the monkey mind. But when it gets clear and you really can, a sentence can arise in your mind, and then another part of your mind can see that thing having arisen and respond to it and say, that is a beautiful sentence, that is a beautiful idea, and then record it. That is the dialogical phenomenon happening that leads to so much creative work in solitude.
Now, one of the most intriguing examples you write about is Andrew, this pair of DJ performance artists. Can you tell me about them?
Andrew are the perfect polar opposite of Emily Dickinson. She is, you know, a 19th century figure, and we can barely, you know, see the way she looked. And these guys are in Technicolor. They're very contemporary. They use all kinds of gadgets in their work, video.
They're Siamese twins, right?
They are. They're performance artists and DJs, and they are never in public without the other, and they always wear identical clothing, and they say that they don't own any clothing that's not identical, that they threw everything away when they really became fused. And they also do not disclose any details about their lives, their last names, or anything that would allow the public to distinguish them. They're very interested in this project of being a joint persona, and they love and really thrive on having as little distance between them as possible. And if you look at Emily Dickinson, who needed a vast amount of distance, and Andrew on the other extreme, that sort of maps out the territory of options available to creative people. Most people are going to be somewhere in between, but it helps you see the choices that we have.
Now, you interviewed Andrew, right?
I did.
What was that like?
It was intriguing. I noticed it's overwhelming, the physical sense. They're in their white suits, they're wearing the same glasses, their hair is, you know, gelled in the same way. I noticed over the course of the conversation that one of them, his hair got a little tasseled, and I was like, okay, well, there's a slight distinction. And then a half hour later, as they were beginning their performance, I could see that he had gone to the bathroom and put some more gel in his hair, so it looked identical to the other Andrew again. And that there's a sense that they are constantly noticing each other and responding to each other, so that, you know, in order to maintain this absence of distinction, that's not like a thing that just happens. It's a process of constant work.
So doing all of this research on creative pairs, has this affected the way you think about your own creative work as a writer? I mean, you already mentioned the interaction you have with your editor, but has it, uncovered anything for you?
It's totally changed the way I think about my work as a writer, and I'm still, you know, working with the implications. I'm starting a new project now, and I'm thinking so much about what's the context in which I do it. Every month I send work to a writer's group, which I started when I was writing this book, because I knew I needed these two guys that I'm in this group with bring something out of me that's very special. My editor, Eamon Dolan, also is a critical partner and the co-creator of this book. And I just look at relationships as the center of everything now. But I also am acutely aware that a relationship only works at a high level when both people within it are operating at the highest level for themselves personally. And so it seems like a paradox, but it's absolutely true that sometimes the best way to serve a relationship is to go back to yourself and to water your own roots and to say, what do I most believe in and what do I care about the most? And that's where you find me now. I mean, I am touring for this book, and I'm promoting this book that I wrote in very intimate and relentless exchange with my editor over 5 years. And it's like we're delivering a child into the world that the two of us made together, and I believe in it, and he and I will always be linked by that. At the same time, I'm asking, well, what do I want to do next? What do I want to do next? Now, of course, that is going to lead me into some kind of partnership once I've answered the question tentatively. But it's an experience of the self that is, in this moment, feels slightly primary to the experience of the we. And that dance is, I mean, that's what I think about all day long these days.
Well, that is fascinating. Thank you so much for talking about this.
Thank you. Your questions were terrific. And I really enjoy these kinds of conversations because it's a small model of what the book is all about.
True. Yes, absolutely. The art of the interview. That's to some degree, that's what you're talking about.
Well, interviewers are, and you know, people who are in sync with your work and have really taken it in a deep way. It's it's really amazing when you experience that at a high level, as I've done with you. And then the opposite is just so, it's remarkable how my thinking totally falls apart when I'm in conversation with someone who's just punching the clock and hasn't really gotten it, maybe read the press release or maybe even read the book, but just, you know, is not at all thinking about it the way that I do.
Well, thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, that was great.